The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the Pancreas is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
The usual disclaimer. When you talk about diseases of the pancreas, you're by and large talking a lot about pancreatitis, both acute and chronic, and we'll throw in a couple of other things that you occasionally see to try to make you as ready for the boards or update your knowledge as much as we possibly can. So, acute pancreatitis. Most people will recover from acute pancreatitis. Some will not. They will die. Others will develop chronic pancreatitis. But you can tell by this slide what the usual course of events is for the majority of people. What happens with pancreatitis? What is the pathology that's going on there? This slide depicts a little bit about the physiology of the pancreatic cell and shows you the direction that the manufacturing, if you will, of the enzymes proceeds, and eventually they're secreted into the lumen of the pancreatic duct, and they begin the process of digestion of food. For whatever reason, in the case of pancreatitis, that digestion process doesn't take place in the lumen of the gut, but it takes place in the pancreatic cell itself. It's a process we call autodigestion, and it destroys all of the cells that it comes into contact with. What are the etiologies? Far and away in the United States, alcohol and biliary disease are the biggest causes. There's a group of people with idiopathic pancreatitis that we don't know why they've got it. No alcohol history, no gallstones, no medications of any kind. They are idiopathic until proven otherwise. On the right-hand side there, you can see a list of potential etiologies that we see on occasion. Again, because they're unusual, they will make good board questions. So all of you already know about alcohol and biliary disease, so the list on the right there is probably the most important for you. And we'll spend just a little bit of time on a couple of those. Annular pancreas is a congenital abnormality. The pancreas, instead of being contiguous with the small bowel, wraps around it in utero for whatever the reason, and usually they present at some point with a bowel obstruction. Sphincter of OD dysfunction. Now this, I think this has been modified since I made this slide, but sphincter of OD dysfunction, you can think of it if you want to as a spasm of the sphincter of OD that then probably increases the pressure in the pancreatic duct. And a guy by the name of Janine, I think he had a partner at the University of Wisconsin, first described this years and years ago when I was a GI fellow. They had three types. I think they've done away with a couple of the types, but at any rate, know that there is such an entity as sphincter of OD dysfunction, and that it may be a cause of pancreatitis. If you can diagnose it, ERCP and sphincterotomy is the way that it gets treated. What about drugs? What medicines have been reported to cause pancreatitis? On the left, you see a group of drugs that are common that cause pancreatitis. We see these periodically. I use a fair amount of azathioprine, as we discussed in the last lecture, and on occasion, I get a patient that comes back in after the first dose or two and has pancreatitis. The drugs in the middle are uncommon, but they have been reported, and the ones on the far right are rare. They have been reported, but not very, very often like the others. Increased enzymes, amylase and lipase. We use these to diagnose, and we use them to monitor the progress of how a patient is doing. There are other things that cause elevation, both of the amylase and the lipase. Probably the one to be most aware of is macroamylasemia that you see down there at the bottom. Because you might get asked a question about a patient who seems to be fairly asymptomatic at this point, had pancreatitis maybe a month ago, but their serum amylase continues to run very, very high. Why is that? Probably the answer in that case is because they have macroamylasemia. The lab can figure that out for you if you ask them. But diseases in these other areas, parotitis, biliary stones, intestinal injury, tubal ovarian disease, renal failure, all of those can give you a high amylase and it has nothing to do with pancreatitis. Lipase is the same way, but the sources of extra pancreatic lipase are fewer. Another scenario you could see is patient comes in after 3 or 4 days of intense abdominal pain. ER doctor checks an amylase and a lipase, and the amylase is normal, but the lipase is elevated. Well, how could that possibly be? Well, the reason is because these abnormal enzymes peak and then fall off fairly rapidly, and there's a gap here between when the amylase comes back down to normal and the lipase does. So if this patient makes the ER about this point right here, then they're going to have a high lipase and a normal amylase. When that autodigestion process starts and it begins to eat up the pancreas, the fact that the pancreas doesn't have a serosa allows the products of inflammation to virtually go anywhere in the body. There's a pancreatic encephalopathy that affects the brain. It can move all the way down into the lower extremities and cause problems in the lower extremities. Most of the time we see it in the abdomen causing the trouble that it does. And you can see here the route that it may take once it begins to move out away from the pancreas and into the rest of the abdominal cavity. First few hours are critical in the care of acute pancreatitis. These are some of the things you have to watch for: encephalopathy, hypoxemia, tachycardia, hypotension, high hematocrit, oliguria, azotemia. Notice that all but the top two on that list are secondary to lack of fluid. A pancreatitis patient is very dehydrated most of the time because they've been vomiting, they may have had diarrhea, they've got inflammation going on in their abdominal cavity, and they're third spacing a lot of fluid, and they're almost all of them dry by the time they get into the hospital. And treatment-wise, there's two important things you can do for the patient with acute pancreatitis. One is IV fluids about as fast as you can give them, and pain control. Control the pain. It's because without controlling the pain, the pancreatitis seems to get worse and you're not making any progress. So IV fluids and pain control are essential in the treatment of acute pancreatitis. There's some other things you may do depending on the circumstance that we'll go over as well. This slide just shows you some of the players that are involved in this inflammatory process, and I don't know that one of these is any worse than the others. Phospholipase A2 is a bad actor in this scenario because it continues to aggravate the inflammatory process, and all of these substances probably do to some degree. And you can see on the outside there in the boxes the areas where these substances affect and cause problems. Physical exam-wise, there may not be very much of anything initially on the examination of an acute pancreatitis patient, but there's some well-known physical exam signs that oftentimes will show up on a board exam. If you were asked to see a patient and they showed you this picture, either one of these pictures or the next one, and asked you what the diagnosis was if the patient had severe upper abdominal pain, fever, tachycardia, those type of symptoms, the answer is going to be acute pancreatitis. Now, these are not specific. These signs here, Cullen's sign and Gray-Turner's sign, are not specific for acute pancreatitis. They can occur with any abdominal catastrophe. But in the right scenario with the right symptoms, they're significant for acute pancreatitis. Ranson's criteria, we still teach this primarily because it's still on the boards the last time I checked. Ranson was a surgeon back in the 30s, I believe, who was trying to find a way to prognosticate for patients with acute pancreatitis. How is this patient going to do? Are they going to be well, or are they going to die, or somewhere in between? So Ranson came up with these criteria that you assess at admission and then again in 48 hours. And you can, it takes 2 days, obviously, 48 hours, but you can prognosticate to some degree what's going to happen with this particular patient. It's been demonstrated that a good clinician who is thorough and knows what they're doing can prognosticate almost as well as somebody using the Ranson's criteria. These are a little bit cumbersome. I don't know of anybody that uses it in the clinic. It's really more of a research tool, but you'll probably still see it in a particular situation. Ranson score of 2, day 1. Ranson score of 6, day 2. What's that? What does that mean? Well, it means the prognosis is getting worse. They're not doing as well. In addition to Ranson's, there's also some other classification systems for acute illness, the Glasgow scale, the Apache acute measurement scale, I think it's in its third iteration by now, something like that. But there's other methods besides Ranson's criteria that you can try to gauge prognosis with in any sick patient, but especially in pancreatitis. So the higher, obviously, the higher the number on the Ranson score, the worse their prognosis. Treatment, again, supportive care. I can't overemphasize aggressive fluid and electrolyte replacement with pain control. You monitor the usual stuff, urine output, vital signs, oxygen saturation, all of that. Now, other treatments on the right there that may be significant. Some people find acid suppression is helpful. If the amount of gastric acid is reduced, they feel like the pancreas isn't working as hard. I don't know that there's any evidence for that, but antibiotics are not recommended initially. NG tube, you all know as well as I do of all the things we do to people, probably they hate an NG tube worse than anything else that we do. So unless they're vomiting, it's probably not worth putting an NG tube down. Nutritional support doesn't have any place in the treatment of pancreatitis early. It may, if the disease goes on 5, 6, 7 days and your patient still isn't able to take oral nutrition. Urgent ERCP, only if there's good evidence of a common duct stone. Only if there's good evidence of a common duct stone should you do an ERCP, because an ERCP can aggravate pancreatitis. So you don't do it unless you don't have much choice. This is a little bit of a busy slide. It shows you how resuscitation should go. We've already talked about some of it. The most important thing to remember is lots and lots of fluids, pain control, and then we're going to talk about a little bit about what happens when you find problems in your patient like ischemia of the pancreas or necrotic areas in the pancreas. Nutrition support, talked about that already. Here's some of the major complications. Local fluid collections in or around the pancreas, necrosis of the pancreas, infection, ascites, erosion into adjacent structures like the stomach, small bowel, GI obstruction, secondary to edema and inflammation, hemorrhage, and then some of the systemic things on the right-hand side. What causes death? Well, early on, in other words, less than 1 week after they become ill, systemic inflammatory response syndrome is what gets a lot of people. It's just very difficult to treat that. That means they're severely ill to start with. Same with multi-organ failure. If they have several organ systems that are starting to fail, it's bad news. Later in the process, multi-organ failure is still a possibility, and pancreatic infections or pancreatic sepsis takes people later in the process of this disease. Removing impacted stones, again, mentioned that with an ERCP. Removing ascites, and these are things that have been tried. Several years ago, there were two surgeons by the name of Paxton and Payne, and everybody who came in with acute pancreatitis, they took them to the OR and lavaged their abdomen to get rid of all the inflammatory processes that were going on. I don't know how many patients they did that way, but all of them died. And so the study was ended fairly early. I don't know how many people had to die before they stopped the study, but removing the ascites or removing the inflammatory process just doesn't do any good. So there's no reason to go to the OR unless you've got something specific that you're after. Removing circulating proteases. Some of these things like fresh frozen plasma, plasmapheresis, have been tried with not much success. Removing oxygen-derived free radicals, again, sounds like intuitively like it should help, but doesn't seem to. Pseudocyst is a fairly late complication, and a pseudocyst, if it's small enough, like under 4 or 5 centimeters, usually is just observed, but if it's bigger or it ruptures or it's causing pain, then it may have to be taken care of. Here's the first CT. This is the pancreas here, and this is later in the course of the disease. You can see the pseudocyst here. There it is on that one. So it depends on how big it is as far as what the treatment is. Now, the radiologist can put a needle in that and drain it, and you can hope that that's all it takes, but when they get to be this size, it's probably going to have to be treated surgically. But having the radiologist needle it and drain it will buy you some time before you have to take the patient to the OR. Complications of a pseudocyst: severe pain, obstruction of the CBD or the duodenum, that's common bile duct, dissection of the pseudocyst, bleeding, infection, leakage, and rupture. Those are all things that you want to try and avoid if you can. Abscess. This is the thing we probably fear the most in treating patients with acute pancreatitis. And usually what happens is they develop an area of necrosis and the necrosis becomes infected. It's recommended that if the patient's sick enough and you want to do a CT scan when they come in, you do one on day one, and then you wait 3 days to repeat it, because the process of necrosis takes that long before you're going to see any difference in the CT scan. Almost everybody should have an ultrasound before they leave the emergency room looking for gallstones or a dilated common bile duct. A CT scan you may or you may not do, depending on how ill they are. But what you see here, this is an abscess, and probably everybody's too far away to be able to appreciate that there are some gas bubbles here at the top. So this is a gas-forming organism of some sort. The radiologist is putting a needle in here to obtain some material for cultures and Gram stain. Again, like the pseudocyst, needle aspiration is not going to cure this. This is a surgical problem, so they have to go to the OR to get the abscess taken care of. And obviously, they're quite sick, so some of them don't survive. Now, I mentioned a CT scan day one and day three. Well, here's day one. The pancreas is a bit on the edematous side, but really doesn't look too much. It doesn't look real abnormal other than that. Well, this patient apparently didn't progress, and so on day three, they got another one, and look at the difference in the pancreas. This is all necrosis here that you're seeing. The pancreas, at least the majority of it, has died. Now, one of two things is going to happen with necrosis. Either it's going to remain a sterile necrosis, in which case you can probably observe, unless they deteriorate, or it's going to become infected, in which case, again, they have to go to the OR. They have to be on antibiotics, but it's bad news when they get that far. Another view of the same thing. Obviously, there's no perfusion here going through this part of the pancreas. It's dead tissue, but they don't all get infected. Some of them do well even without antibiotics and going to the operating room. So you have to decide, do we debride or do we observe? You want to keep as many people as you can out of the OR because they're sick to start with and they tend to not do well. Signs of infected necrosis. Okay, you've got a CT scan on day three. You showed that CT I just showed you on an exam question. A couple of days later, your patient has a fever. Their white count's going up with a left shift. They've got a high CRP. What's going on? Well, obviously the area that you were concerned about with necrosis has started to become infected. So you do two things. You start antibiotics and you have a biopsy, or you have the radiologist put a needle in the pancreas and remove some material for cultures to find out what kind of a bug is growing there. These are the signs. So here's what that looks like in this case. You can see the radiologist needle here, and these are some of the organisms that they cultured to allow them. This is, again, the needle and the organisms here to allow them to treat specifically this infection. Now, again, they're still going to have to go to the OR, but you want the most specific antibiotic that you can get, obviously. So if it's a sterile necrosis, continued medical therapy, debridement for persistent organ failure, if necessary. If it's infected, antibiotics and debridement. Pretty straightforward. Chronic pancreatitis. Biggest etiology in the United States is alcohol. And there used to be this classification system of chronic relapsing and acute relapsing, and there was four or five different categories, but it wasn't helpful at all clinically, and so now it's pretty much back to just acute and chronic pancreatitis. Alcohol is the biggest offender. There's a group of people that have idiopathic chronic pancreatitis. We don't know why they have it. And on the right there, you see several different things that can also cause chronic pancreatitis. Pain, diarrhea, weight loss, malnutrition, pancreatic insufficiency, those are all complications of chronic pancreatitis. Diabetes is a later complication. It doesn't occur early, but it tends to come on late in the course of the disease. There's loss of insulin and glucagon. They do not usually go into ketoacidosis. That's something you usually don't have to worry about. Only when the disease is severe, it tends to be somewhat brittle. Their insulin requirement tends to be low, so it's completely different than type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Yeah, still have to take care of it with diet and some medication, but it's not as bad as if the patient was diabetic. Diagnostic tests that we use to diagnose chronic pancreatitis. In this day and age, probably the studies on the left-hand side of your screen are all the ones you're ever going to see or use. And that's because you can well define the anatomy of the pancreas and its drainage system, either with CT scanning, MRI, or an ERCP. The ones on the right are still there because it may still show up on the boards. These are old tests. They were never done very often. The secretin test is cumbersome. I'll show you how it works here in a minute. But these are all fairly nonspecific, and they don't really tell you that much information. So we usually don't worry too much about function. We concentrate on structure in order to diagnose chronic pancreatitis. Clinical assessment, pain, malabsorption, weight loss could be on that list. Imaging is number one if it hasn't been done. Trial of pancreatic enzymes, and if you feel the need, you can do one of those tests of pancreatic insufficiency, but they don't add too much to the evaluation. Here's what a secretin test is. They put a nasogastric tube down through the stomach out into the duodenum, and then they inject parenterally secretin. In a patient with a normally functioning pancreas, they will then extrude into the duodenum a certain volume of bicarb and fluid, and that can be aspirated through the NG tube and measured. When they have pancreatitis, as you can see on the slide there, the volume of bicarb and fluid is significantly reduced, and that's a sign that they have chronic pancreatitis. Their pancreas isn't functioning anymore the way that it used to, but it's a time-consuming test. It's not specific. You know, where's the break point between chronic pancreatitis and normal? It's just not worth doing most of the time. This is an ERCP x-ray of a pancreatic duct. Now, if you don't do these, you may not be able to appreciate this, but this duct is very ectatic. It's bumpy. It's irregular. It's not smooth like a pancreatic duct should be. This is a classic picture of chronic pancreatitis from an ERCP standpoint. This is an ultrasound of the pancreas, and what you're seeing here are calcifications. Same over here. Anytime you see calcifications, that patient has chronic pancreatitis until proven otherwise. Here they are in the head of a pancreas on a CT scan. You can also see a dilated pancreatic duct. This is a plain film of the abdomen. You can see the calcifications even on this right here. Head of the pancreas again. They're not real clear like they were on the CT scan, but they're definitely there. Patient with pancreatitis starts to vomit blood. And you scope them, you don't see anything in the esophagus, but you get into the stomach and you retroflex the scope, and you're looking there at gastric varices. This is every gastroenterologist's nightmare, because gastric varices are very difficult to treat. There's not a great treatment for them. There's a couple of things on the horizon that may be, but right now they're very difficult to treat if they're bleeding. But if you have a patient that has no esophageal varices but has gastric varices, what you're probably looking at is a patient who has a splenic vein thrombosis because of the inflammation in the splenic vein. And that has caused these gastric varices. And if they bleed, it's tough. It's real difficult to take care of them. They may have to do a splenectomy in that situation. Cystic neoplasms, not that common, but with the advent of MRI, we're seeing more of them than we ever have before because the MRI has such detail. The ones that it usually picks up, though, are small and probably, for the most part, insignificant. But clinical clues as far as a cystic neoplasm goes includes no prior pancreatitis, because it may be a pseudocyst if that's the case, unexplained pancreatitis as a result of the cyst, cyst present on the first CT scan. So the diagnosis includes fluid analysis, EUS, ERCP, or maybe resection if it's large enough and it's causing problems. There's several different types of cystic pancreatic lesions. This is not an exhaustive list by any stretch of the imagination. These are probably some of the more common ones that you will see. I've talked about the pseudocyst. The serous cyst adenoma has a very low malignant potential. Mucinous cyst adenoma and mucinous cyst adenocarcinoma, though, have a high potential for malignancy, and it takes a biopsy to be able to figure out exactly which one of these that you're dealing with. Nutritional management of exocrine insufficiency, pancreatic insufficiency. I mentioned pancreatic enzymes. Obviously, they have, even if they weren't very much of a drinker before, they can't drink at all now. Medium chain triglycerides don't require any digestive enzymes to be absorbed, and so medium chain triglycerides are a very good thing to use in these folks. Vitamin supplements, again, a PPI to inhibit gastric acid production may help. So there's several things you can do. Usually they end up seeing the dietitian for some specific diets that are around for chronic pancreatitis patients. Pain management. Again, no alcohol. At least things don't get worse usually if they don't drink. They may not get better either, but analgesia, enzyme replacement, neurolytic therapy, in other words, an interventional radiologist can inject lidocaine well, they can use several different things, but they can inject the celiac axis, give the patient some long-lasting pain relief. Pseudocyst drainage, if they have one of those. Duct decompression, if they have biliary or pancreatic stones. You can have stones in the pancreatic duct just like you do the biliary tract. For whatever reason, the uncoated enzymes, you can get enzymes in two different varieties, either coated or uncoated. I don't know why the uncoated ones seem to work better, but they do in chronic pancreatitis. So if you want to use pancreatic enzymes, use the ones that are uncoated. Steatorrhea, again, because of malabsorption from no functional pancreas. Oftentimes, a patient may complain of excessively foul-smelling stools, stools that float on the top of the water, but that's inconsistent. You may or you may not see that. You may have to collect stool and assay for fat to see if the patient's actually having steatorrhea. This happens because of a decreased amount of lipase and colipase, a decreased pH, and rather than break down fats and absorb them, they just go on out through the small bowel into the colon. What's the risk of pancreatic cancer? Well, you can see there it's 3 to 15 times greater in a patient with chronic pancreatitis. Again, probably just like with the colon and inflammatory bowel disease, it's more likely due to the chronic inflammation that goes on in the organ more than anything else. But they do have a significant increase in the incidence of adenocarcinoma of the pancreas. Well, what can you do about it? Well, not very much. It's recommended, I think, that if you do want to screen an ultrasound a couple of times a year and follow the amylase and lipase if you want to, but there isn't a good way to screen and follow these folks that guarantees you'll find a small tumor and allow them to get a surgical cure. There are a few illnesses. These are good to keep in mind. A few surgeries that may cause pancreatic insufficiency that would be good to keep in your head when you take your board exams: cystic fibrosis, tumors of the pancreas, a syndrome there, Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, that I never heard of until I started putting this thing together a few years ago. Childhood pancreatic atrophy and some other oddball type of things that you see there that have been reported to cause pancreatic insufficiency. Autoimmune pancreatitis. On imaging, it looks like there is diffuse pancreatic duct narrowing, and there may look to be a pancreatic tumor. The autoimmune pancreatitis may present that way. They have an increased amount of autoantibodies, elevated gamma globulins or IgG4, and they usually present with abdominal pain. So they get worked up. People oftentimes think they have a pancreatic tumor, and it may just be the autoimmune pancreatitis. Maybe asymptomatic. Acute pancreatitis is rare. Obstructive jaundice can occur. Other organ involvement, you can see there what some of the other involvement may include: biliary, liver, kidney, and lung. But the good thing is it does respond to steroids. What I can't tell you is how long you have to treat with steroids before you can wean them off. It's a trial and error type of thing if the steroids work. If they do work, wean them off and see if they continue to feel good. The course of chronic pancreatitis, eventually pancreas usually burns out completely. The good thing about that is that the pain goes away when that happens usually, but the diabetes and the steatorrhea usually don't. You usually have to continue to treat them. Last slide, I think. Yep.